Hello everyone, we are at the Chalk Valley History Festival, and yes, I know we're near Salisbury, we're in inland, miles away from anywhere vaguely nautical, but there is actually a fair amount of nautical history here. So if we come over here, we're going to spin around, and we have here a rather lovely long white boat with 4R on it. Now, as you can probably tell from the ladder next to it, it's not exactly the world's largest boat, but this is a replica of CMB-4, or Coastal Motorboat 4, one of the earliest true torpedo boats, as in small, fast attack craft, as compared to the slightly more ocean-going torpedo boats that preceded her and then later evolved into destroyers. Now, I say replica, the original does still exist over in Portsmouth in Boathouse 4. If you go down to the Royal Historic Dockyard, you can visit her there. This is a replica, which is obviously a little bit safer to haul around. So as we go round her, I'm very lucky to be joined by two of the volunteers who actually helped construct this replica and have obviously learned a huge amount about her history. And we have, closest to us, is Martin Kelly.
David Griffiths.
David Griffiths. Well, 50-50.
Yes.
50-50 chance. So David has also written a rather excellent book. I already have a copy, but if you don't, there's it. Coastal Motorboats of Thornycroft and the Origins of the Fast Attack Craft. So definitely pick up a copy if you can. So perhaps as we go round, could you explain to us a little bit more about how she was constructed? How did it go? How did you go about actually taking your original and then going, we want one that we can take back out to sea again?
Yes, well, we didn't precisely take the original. I was lucky enough to figure out that the people at the Royal Museum's Greenwich held the original plans.
Okay.
So I was able to get about 60 of the original plans copied, and we were able to work from those original plans. So we had, primarily, we had the most important was the lines plan, and we also had a general arrangement plan, so we could figure out where everything would go. So we constructed her on the floor of the boathouse in Portsmouth with built her upside down, which is the traditional way of building these. The hull of the boat is built exactly as the originals were built. So she's got an internal keel system off which everything else is built. There are ribs, if you like, going around the circumference of the boat based on 4-inch centers. And there are stringers on the inside of the boat going down about approximately a foot apart. There are stringers going all that way along the boat. Mm-hmm. So then the interior-wise, she's very modern. We wanted a boat that would last a long time and was stronger than those built in 1916 and so on. We walk around the side of the boat here, and I'll explain a little bit about the dynamics of the boat. She's famously known as a hydroplaning boat, and this is what gave her the extra speed over other boats of conventional hulls at the time. Mm-hmm. So this boat here has if we walk down here, you'll see that the chine, there's a chine line that starts to come in here and develops all the way down the boat to this point here, on the midships line, exactly halfway the length of the boat, 20 feet, 20 feet either way. So this is the hydroplaning step, which extends across underneath the boat. At about the midships line, the step is about 2.5 inches. So what this does is when the boat gets up to speed, it's got water is rushing this way forward, and it comes behind the step and starts to rotate like that, which causes aeration. So when the water is aerated, it weighs less than it does when it's not aerated. And this creates a bit of a vacuum, which allows the boat to lift. So she runs at a hydroplaning speed, which is about 17 or 18 knots onwards. She's riding on the step here. She's also riding back here on the flat, flattened out bit of the transom. So she has three contact points with the water, one at the step, one at the transom, and obviously one other at the propeller. So that moves her along at 17 or 18 knots, she starts to come up. And then by 25, so she becomes right up, And then we can move her up to 35 or even 39 knots. And she's quite stable. And you obviously have somewhat less control over the boat when you're not so full in the water.
Yes, and then obviously, so when she's in her attack mode, we've got the traditional steering linkage down, so that's going up to the ship's wheel.
Correct.
And that turns the arm, that turns the rudder. So there's not really a huge amount of mechanical advantage involved there.
No.
When she's going fast, you really feel it when you're turning her.
You certainly do, yes. And she tends to pull to starboard more than she does to port. And we've decided that this was, well, we now know that this is based, the guys who were driving these in 1916 and so on experienced the same thing. Part of the problem with is the amount of thrust coming off the prop at this point, and you've only got a rudder that it extends to half the depth of the propeller. So because of the prop spinning whichever way to starboard like that, she tends to want to pull that way. So you have to overcompensate when you're steering.
Bit like high torque aircraft, they want to twist in the direction of the
engine.
Exactly
right.
So then when she's in going full on and she wants to release her torpedo, obviously a larger craft like a destroyer in World War One would have torpedo tubes firing their torpedoes literally with powder charge. This is just a slide rail off the stern.
Well, it's not. I'll step in there.
Okay.
It is a sliding rail off the back of the boat, but the trick is that if you can see, we'll get around there. There's a lever in the bridge.
Okay.
That the captain, the skipper, when he's ready, he's going to drive his boat in the direction of the target boat. Mm-hmm. When he's ready, he pulls that lever there, and that does two things. It releases a set of lugs inside the torpedo trough, and having already loosened these blocks up here, mm-hmm. So it releases some lugs in the torpedo trough. At the same time, it moves a lanyard, pulls a lanyard, which detonates a charge of a pistol bullet, mm-hmm. pistol shot, which the exhausting gases from the bullet then go into a small tube up to a big ram, which is across the bridge, which we don't have on our reproduction boat. It's cramped enough in there anyway.
Yeah.
So the expanding gases go into this piston, into the cylinder, and push the piston down the shaft of the cylinder, and then push the torpedo off, gently off the back of the boat. As it goes off the back of the boat, there's another lanyard on there that is snagged, and that sets the motor running. And once the torpedo drops in, it will drop to about 18 feet. Mm-hmm. The motor will have been kicking in, of course, and will be getting up to speed. So as the speed on the propeller picks up, it then brings, and the gyroscope worked in conjunction, brings the torpedo up to wherever you want it to be, which you would normally set for about 9 feet on something like this in order to hit a suitable target. Deep enough. So the big question is, people always ask, well, how come you don't get hit by your own torpedo? And the answer to that is because this torpedo is going to run at about 9 feet below the surface, mm-hmm. and you're only drawing 3.5 feet. So you've got 5.5 feet, six feet between you and the torpedo. But of course, you're going to be getting out of the way. Once you've dropped your fish, as they said, you're going to get right out of the way, because you're closing very quickly on your target, mm-hmm. and you're probably at 500 yards, and so they've woken up and they're shooting at you. So you make a hard turn to get out the way, and the torpedo continues in its trajectory.
So you point yourself in the direction the torpedo wants. You want the torpedo to go, and then you release it, and hopefully the torpedo will go in that direction.
Yeah. And that's precisely how the Oleg was sunk, mm-hmm. in June of 1919.
So that was in the intervention against the Bolsheviks immediately after the First World War.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the
Russian War of Independence, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
and that the success of the sinking the Oleg was then encouraged the Admiralty to send six more boats up of the bigger 79A. There is a 55-foot boat with two twin torpedoes, mm-hmm. twin engine, twin torpedoes.
Same launch method?
Yes.
Same launch method off the stern. So apart from just the fact that this isn't exactly the world's largest boat, it was that pretty much the main driver behind having this stern launching method as opposed to the forward launching method you'd see on World War One, also World War Two MTBs and E-boats or Chanel boat, etc. Was that pretty much the driving factor or
no.
was additional stuff?
No. The driving factor was the weight of the boat, mm-hmm. Then the speed of the boat. The Navy wanted a boat that weighed no more than 4.5 tons for these 40-foot boats. They weren't thinking about 55s, obviously, initially, but Thornycroft, who'd been racing boats in the 1900s, had developed very fast boats, which he raced at Monaco and so on. and he had he was of the opinion that in a future war, the boats could be widened out at the stern and carry a torpedo. Because as I think you referred to at the beginning there were conventional torpedo boats, but they were big and they were slow and they were lumbering and they didn't move fast, so they presented somewhat of a target, an easier target. So the development of this was he wanted to use one of his faster boat designs was based on Carina. So the engine is fairly forward in this boat. Mm-hmm. So given that the engine is forward, you've got to offset the weight of the engine with the weight of the torpedo in the aft end here. So they did spend quite a lot of time trying to decide how to launch the torpedo. They had several ideas, one of which was to lift the have a mechanism whereby the torpedo would be lifted up, out, and down. Mm-hmm. And that would obviously kind of create a problem with your center of gravity, at least on a single torpedo boat.
Yeah.
We had one idea where they would have a big opening in the middle of the hull and drop it straight through.
Ah, okay.
But that would have meant you'd need two engines or at least two propellers running off a gearbox to have a prop there and a prop there.
Yeah,
because you couldn't have a prop shaft running down the center line of the boat. So as late as October 1915, John I. Thornycroft's son, Tom, was making drawings with the torpedo going that way off the boat. So the obvious problem with firing it facing that way is that to get to your target, you've got to drive up to your target and turn around, so you're then
running away
back end onto your target, giving them a lot more time to shoot you. So then they started playing with the idea of, can we drop it off the back end? And it came about that they did. And the calculations, which I've got copies of, show that when they dropped this off, it only changed the center of gravity by about 14 inches. But of course, when you drop this off the other end, you've got a lot less weight on the boat, so you've got an extra 2 or 3 knots on your engine. So it's very advantageous to getting away. So stealth was its main weapon. They had a couple of Lewis guns, some of them, but stealth was its main weapon. And in fact, famously, at Kronstadt, when the big raid happened, the Navy cooperated, worked with the Air Force. And as the 55-foot boats went into Kronstadt, the Navy was flying aircraft overhead and bombing. And, of course, the boats and the planes sound the same. And the Russians weren't expecting a raid from the sea. They thought Kronstadt was completely defensible. So they'd been softened up by aircraft flying overhead and bombing them for a couple of weeks. Anyway, so all attention was to the sky, so the boats came in under the cover of the noise of aircraft.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. High power engines, they're going to sound roughly the same, and then the next thing you know, I suppose the other advantage of this rear launch is if you're looking for the wake of a torpedo, initially, even if you spot the boat, you're going to see the wake of the boat, which is a lot more obvious, and it's only when that boat breaks off you might see the torpedo wake come past that point, but you might also be distracted by the fact there's a boat
motoring
away at high speed.
You might. However, as when we've been out on this thing, I remember one time we came in, I think I was on a support boat at the time, and there was a Brittany Ferries coming out of Portsmouth, and we were bobbing along. This was bobbing along just waiting for the channel to clear. And the size of this compared to the Brittany ferries was, you know, remarkable. Almost hard, difficult to see. And I thought about that, and the Oleg was a third smaller than the Brittany ferries. But if you're not expecting something out there, this is a very small boat to see out there. You know, you'd see it at a few hundred feet. But if you've got a slight chop on the water, you might not see it when it's half a mile away.
And obviously, when successfully sank the Oleg, I believe a couple of the other boats got some torpedoes off as well during the raid. But the Oleg's the one that sank.
The Oleg is the one that sank in June of 1919, and there was a raid that was conducted solely by Augustus Agar in CMB4. His other CMB in the Baltic at the time was CMB7. Mm-hmm. Which was out of action because they'd hit an underwater breakwater or something, mm-hmm. and they'd broken a propeller off.
Okay.
So Agar did this on his own. The Kronstadt raid in August of 1919, mm-hmm. several successful shots were fired. Less successful than conventional writing suggested because they sank outright a Russian hospital ship which had already been decommissioned, so that wasn't exactly a great victory. They hit one other ship, and I'll get these mixed up, but I think it was the Andrei Pervovzani, mm-hmm. And that put her out of action, and the Petrovsk or something, mm-hmm. was also hit but wasn't sunk, as they said at the time. In fact, the great irony is that one of these ships made it to the 1937 fleet review in the Solent under the name Marat.
Ah, yes, so one of the Russian dreadnoughts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the Russian dreadnoughts always have that habit with the Soviet Union. They've renamed about three times, some of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the second raid with the larger boats where there's multiple boats, and this is just the solo operation.
Right.
Right. So can we go up the steps and have a bit of a look at the overview? Right, so we're looking at the interior. So as we've already mentioned, there's a lot of modern stuff there. But we've also got some of the more traditional wheel and so forth. And we mentioned there would have been a ram to release the torpedo. So what's she like performance-wise when you take her out?
She's exciting. And once you get above a certain speed, the front lifts, mm-hmm. and you've got the air going underneath, and that's good. You feel that she suddenly gets light. I was involved in the construction of the boat, mm-hmm. so I can tell you a lot about the way we actually built her, if you like.
Yes, please.
So there are ribs every 100 millimetres, 4 inches. This was obviously designed in 1915 and 16, so everything is in inches. Mm-hmm. There are main frames every 4 feet. The boat is 40 foot long, so there are 10 frame sections. On top of the ribs, mm-hmm. There are two layers, one layer of 1/4 inch and one layer of 3/8 inch mahogany. And that is as the original construction. That's the whole of the boat, with the exception of the step, where there is an additional layer, and that's filled in solid so that you can't get water in there. The planking was put on using a modern method, using modern glues and fixings, but otherwise it was built exactly according to the original plans.
You can see there's even rivets in there.
There are rivets using copper nails and groves, yes, lots of them. But we did decide not to rivet every plank and every junction, because we just didn't have the manpower or indeed the access. Because if you look at the fore and aft ends, getting to the end there is actually quite a problem. And with roving, you need somebody inside the boat as well as outside. So it's a bit of a problem. The planking is unusually covered with epoxy. And we did that just purely for maintenance purposes. We don't have the facilities for maintaining a wooden boat of this size, and we wanted to reduce the maintenance liability.
But she is her historical colour. This would have just been white paint rather than white epoxy.
It would have been white paint for the use in the Baltic. Mm-hmm. At other times, they did paint them grey. Mm-hmm. The torpedo is a replica, obviously. It's made of wood, using a traditional sort of a variation on the barrel technique to make the surface. I have a big lathe at home, and I made the nose cone and tail cone.
Oh, okay.
And I researched the... you can't really see it, but inside that push bronze-coloured thing, which pushes the... torpedo off the back, inside there is a detonation cap.
Okay.
And they went through various phases. It's quite interesting, but basically, as it goes off the back of the boat, it is not live. Mm-hmm. On the front of that cap, there is a propeller that is operated by the water passing through it, and that screws a pin in, and after a 100 or 200 yards, depending on the speed, it becomes live. Mm-hmm. And then, if it hits anything, it will explode.
So the boat is doubly safe, because obviously earlier we were explaining how, the torpedo's going to run under the boat anyway, because the boat's so shallow draft.
Yes.
Ideally, you want to get out the way just in case, but in an absolute worst-case scenario, if the torpedo's running a bit shallow and it's only just launched and it bumps you... Hopefully, in that very early phase, it's not yet armed. Although, depending on how long it takes to catch up with you, it might be.
It catches up pretty quickly, so it would be in front of you. The other danger of this is that the original engine was a petrol engine.
Yeah.
Designed by Thornycroft. And the petrol tank is underneath the seat there. We've actually got a diesel engine in here for safety. But originally it would have been petrol, with high-octane petrol underneath the seat, which is not exactly designed for safety in the event of a stray bullet.
So if someone's taking pot shots at you, they might miss you, but if they miss slightly low, you probably wish they had hit you instead of the tank.
Yes. The engine is actually forward of the wheel point, and it's a big 350 horsepower diesel.
So the exhaust is presumably coming out of...
No.
For the engine?
It goes out the side there.
Oh, okay. So that... Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Yep, that makes sense.
You would have seen this when you were looking at the starboard side.
Okay, so it's actually very low profile in terms of its emissions as well. You're not going to spot anything...
No,
like
not
smoke
really.
You would from a coal-fired ship coming in.
No. And there were about 40 volunteers worked on this. Mm. I worked on her for about 6 years. From the very start, from lofting the original plans, constructing the plans on the floor, life size, right the way through to the final fixings on the deck, and I made some steps that access the boat, because getting onto the boat from a dock is actually quite awkward.
I was going to say, you've just got these little wooden rails with handholds in them, and that's it, isn't it, if you want to go fore and aft.
Yes.
And I suspect on a curved, smooth surface, being told, go forward and sort something out, and that's your sole method of safety at 35 to 40 knots, would not be a fun experience.
No, indeed it wouldn't. If you look at the pictures of the Baltic, when the originals were in the Baltic, they are covered in ice. You can hardly see the boat for the ice. How they coped with it, I just don't know. These guys must have been really brave.
Well, thank you very much for showing us the replica of CMB4. And, of course, look back around. So, of course, if you want to see both this replica and the original. They're both in Boathouse 4, Portsmouth Historic Dockyard. Of course, there's Warrior, Victory, all the other big boats, but of course this is probably the most lethal of them compared to the others. And of course also in Boathouse 4 there's a bunch of other small craft.
Indeed. On the water there are various different craft, which are Royal Navy or RAF. Mm-hmm. But the other interesting thing is that you may not know, but you can get into the dockyard and look at all these free of charge. You don't have to buy a ticket. If you go to the ticket office and ask for a day pass, mm-hmm. they will give you a day pass into the dockyard and you can go into Boathouse 4. You will have to pay to go to Warrior, Mary Rose and Victory.
Which is why they can check your tickets at those ships, even when you're inside the dockyard.
Indeed. So you can come and look at this boat or any of the others. And at the moment we are restoring an armed steam cutter which dates from the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. We're just about to start work on Green Parrot, which is a boat that the Queen used to review the fleet in some time ago now, about 30 years ago, I think, and various other boats. So we've got a lot of interest, and we're always looking for volunteers as well. So yeah. If anybody thinks they would like to have a go at volunteering, mm-hmm. we're very happy to talk to them.
Oh, excellent. Well, yeah, I mean, there's probably a fair number of people who'll be watching this in the vicinity of Portsmouth who might be able to help out with that. And obviously the high-speed launch, one of the landing craft, and the motor gunboat, they're all available for either charter or individual tickets when you take them out on the water as
they
well.
They are indeed, yes.
And I can tell you from experience, having been on the MGB, it's great fun, especially when you go menacing a tanker in the Solent and just spinning round and round and round it, highlighting just how slow they are compared to attack craft.
Well, recently I chartered a landing craft that we have, which is an ex-Falklands War landing craft. It's the only one you can charter. And I got a dozen friends together. We went out for 3 hours. We stormed the beach at Leon Solent and took it unopposed. And then we went off for a lunch and then we did a tour around the harbour. And it cost £25 each.
Which is, that's not bad. No, I think the train ticket to Portsmouth usually costs more than that. And you don't get to storm beaches on a train. They take a dim view of that.
Yeah, so it's a unique experience.
Yeah. So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Boathouse 4 at Portsmouth Historic Dockyard. And, by the time this goes out, Chalk Valley History Festival will be over for this year. But who knows, maybe next year the boat will be back. I certainly hope so. It's a really, really nice bit of naval history. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.